Welcome to the School Sucks Project,
a podcast, YouTube channel, and an online community
dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives,
home education,
critical thinking,
peaceful parenting,
organization and productivity,
and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get
infographics,
comprehensive show notes,
relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast.
And get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
I think if people are talking about political solutions to problems, everything that was actually important about the creation or the expansion of that problem, they missed. So it relates to what you're saying as far as like the cultural, the logical, the philosophical, the psychological. By the time you've got a political problem on your hands, everything that contributed to its cause, it's already too late. So related to this black belt thing that we're talking about and the clear pill as well, I was happy to have a conversation with people who did not feel like it was synonymous with hopelessness or despair, because I don't think it is.
No, I don't think I'm pessimistic. I think I'm realistic, and I think there is hope in certain arenas, and none of them have anything to do with Washington, D.C. that I'm aware of. I think that's good.
Yeah.
I'm tired of this dirty old city and tired too much work and never enough play. And I'm tired of these dirty old sidewalks. Think I'll walk off my steady job today. Turn me loose, set me free. Somewhere in the middle of Montana. Give me all I've got coming to me. And keep your retirement and your so-called social security. Big city, turn me loose and set me free.
Hey, this is Brett. It is the early morning hours of Monday, December 14th, and Scott Hambrick, our dear friend Scott Hambrick from Online Great Books, is back to, most likely, infuriate, I would guess, about half of the audience. The story behind this show, I actually mentioned this in the monologue to the last show, the Black Pill Show. I was trying to get Scott into our Friday anniversary meeting to get some of his thoughts on what was discussed in episode 690. Conversation expanded well beyond that, as you can tell from the title of today's show. Also, very quickly, we decided this should be a regular, like, public podcast, in spite of some confronting and controversial subject matter. In fact, if you're listening to the Patreon version of this show, you get an extra 15 minutes. It includes a pre-show chat and a couple of other sections that I snipped out. If you're just listening to the regular podcast, that stuff is not here. So knowing that this is a follow-up to and an expansion of the conversation that you heard in the previous show, you saw the artwork where the word year is crossed out and it says the Earth in Review. You might get the sense that this isn't the most positive conversation. And while I'm definitely standing by the advice that Wes and I agreed on in an earlier episode in our Integral Theory series, that optimism is the only option right now, I think it is also essential, from the perspective of living consciously, to acknowledge the facts of reality. I would say so that optimism can be directed into the places where it can be most effective. In fact, if you've been enjoying the tone and the content of our shows on Integral Theory over the last month and a half or so, you may not enjoy this. You may not. But Scott and I talk fairly regularly, privately, and I'm also the producer of the Online Great Books podcast. And when we broached the Black Pill topic, I knew he would have a lot to say about it. In fact, I thought that Scott was going to come and offer a different pill, what's called the clear pill. And we're going to discuss that in the show today. It is the formulation of one of the central figures in the NRX movement, who for a long time was known as Mentius Moldbug and now uses his real name, Curtis Yarvin. We'll be discussing him as well. Scott is not a huge fan. But the conversation starts with a history of pills. We'll do red versus blue. We'll talk about the different uses of red. Then we're going to go white versus black. And ultimately, we'll get to this clear pill thing. And of course, we recognize that all of these pills, I said this in the last show, are heuristics, and they're not really useful tools for categorizing people, nor do I think they should be used that way. But, you know, as is the purpose with a heuristic, it allows you to move a larger concept quickly and efficiently. You just have to remember to open it up and look inside as you're moving it around. And I think we do a good job with that in this conversation. But Scott will acknowledge up front that his pill is pretty black at this point. And we'll discuss that. We'll have several disagreements along the way. And I thought this was one of the best conversations, certainly one of the most challenging, that I've had on political and social issues in a long time. I'm happy that this one got recorded. I'm happy that I get to share it with you. This was recorded on Friday in front of a group of university participants. If you're interested in hearing these conversations, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/schoolsucks, or through the AV Club, schoolsucksproject.com/AV. And if you want access to all the presentations in the University Ideas into Action Summit, which includes Zach Slavek, Steve Patterson, Scott Hambrick, Moritz Berling, Jay Dyer, Richard Grove, Kevin Cole, Professor CJ, Kevin Geary, Michael Malice, Tom Woods, and myself, you can go to sspuniversity.com, just spell that university, /ideas into action. Please take a look at this extraordinary resource we've put together, perfect for navigating the times in which we live. If you decide the content is something that you want, and this community that we put together is something that you need right now, go ahead and use the coupon code HAMBRICK, HAMBRICK. You can save 30%, and you can reward Scott for his referral, even if you hate him after this. And even if you hate him, you will also love him. It's going to be weird. So again, sspuniversity.com/ideas into action, coupon code HAMBRICK at checkout. Save 30%. You can access all these great presentations, and you can join our discussions. Also, I cannot recommend highly enough the podcasting dream team of Scott and Carl Schutt in the Online Great Books podcast. You can get to that by going to onlinegreatbooks.com. You can also check out their other podcast called Music and Ideas. I think their most recent episode is Tracing the Origin of the Blues. It is sincerely an honor to be able to work with these guys, to be part of their team at Online Great Books. I feel very lucky to call Scott a friend, and now it's time for him to start pissing you off. Here we go. Right, so I would say this is probably the group that we have. Scott and I are going to talk as a follow-up to the conversations that we've been having. And I also put a podcast out yesterday called The Black Pill, which, if you haven't heard it, was a discussion that I had with a few of my friends in New York last weekend, where my friend said, yeah, my cousin is definitely bringing the black pill. I said, I'm interested in that. I want to learn more. I think it might be something worth incorporating if it's a, you know, rapidly spreading internet philosophy that's informing people's behaviors, worldviews, attitudes towards others, attitudes towards politics. Like, how popular is it? How powerful is it? And so we had that conversation. And I realized that, you know, there's lots of pills right now that people are taking. And Scott and I, we're going to talk a little bit about this clear pill idea, even though Scott has, before I think what people will hear in the recording, Scott has, and correct me if I'm wrong, Scott, you've identified yourself as black-pilled in many ways.
In many, many ways.
And what does that mean to you? Because I'm realizing there was, there's some variety of viewpoints when it comes to this black pill.
Yeah. Well, Carrie asked before we got started if we could define some stuff here.
Absolutely.
I think we probably ought to do that. Although it's hard to define these things because it's all weird internet stuff. And these definitions, you know, are kind of in flux.
But it's so wonderful that that so many things that were never defined are now defined, which just makes it easier to move ideas around.
Are you talking about Urban Dictionary right now?
No. I just mean, like, I think we were talking about this in a meeting. It might have been Monday, my friend Tony Myers and I, and just even like making a term out of white knighting, right? So you saw somebody do something like this in high school and you go, oh, I hate that guy. What a dork. But maybe that guy who you wrote off as a dork is actually a really decent guy with one bad habit that never had a name, like in the 80s or the 90s, and now it has a name. So I think that if you can put a name to a phenomenon or a behavior that you don't like, it's actually moving you a step closer to addressing and solving a problem. So I said that that's one of the assets of all this 4chan culture stuff, is that they're putting names to things that never had, that existed, right? But had no handles to say, here, like, here's a concept, I'm moving it over to you, and now you can examine it. So yeah, I mean, there's some like wobbly definitions and lack of clarity and debate around a lot of this stuff, but I'm glad that people are trying to put names to these things. And I don't want to, but I also don't want to, that being said, collectivize like, oh, you're black-pilled, or you're clear-pilled, or you're red-pilled, or you're blue-pilled. I don't think those are particularly, aside from like the efficiency of the shorthand, I don't think they're very useful ways of talking about people.
Well, yeah. I first encountered the pills, be like most of us, in the Matrix, right? This is where this whole kind of paradigm comes from. In the Matrix, if he takes the blue pill, then he goes back to the old ways and he'll have no recollection of all these things that he has seen. And to take the blue pill is to go back to being a normie. There's another term. But if he takes the red pill, then he gets to see everything from above. He gets to walk out of Plato's cave, right? He gets to see things as they are. And that whole red pill, blue pill thing, when I first saw it crop up outside of the Matrix movie series, was in sort of the men's rights movement.
Yeah.
Where the blue pill people, it's in terms of men and women, or I'm sorry, it's in terms of men almost exclusively and their attitudes towards women. And it's their attitudes towards women aren't what you normally think when somebody says something about that. It's really about a whole way of thinking about the male-female dynamic. So a blue pill man might be somebody who believed his nice aunt's advice about dating,
yeah,
which is wear a nice tie and open the door for her and be super polite and just be yourself and you'll find the woman of your dreams. Meanwhile, the woman of his dreams is dating some guy that doesn't seem to be nice to her, and he's thrilling to her and has some dark triad psychology, and the blue pill guy just can't make inroads with these women he's interested in. But the red pill guy is wide-eyed about this whole situation and understands more about the male-female dynamic than the person who watched sitcoms in the 50s and took their dating advice from those kinds of things, you know.
Can we stop right there? Because this is the place where people start writing letters. Right.
Oh, yeah.
This is a tough one. Right. Because I went through a phase of, I would say, being very red pilled and kind of self-protective and like avoidant attachment. Like I was single for well over 2 years and I integrated a lot of this stuff into my approach with ultimately kind of like looking back, not a tremendous amount of satisfaction, certainly a lot of self-control, certainly a lot of power. But I, you know, I think one of the problems with this, and this is an example that I gave to a friend of mine, is because I have a friend in New Hampshire who has this like sports betting, support website, right? So, I guess it's odds making. They help people who want to do online gambling, place the most realistic bets. So, you know, if a company like this came to you, and this is a metaphor here with this whole men's rights red pill movement, and they said, we can predict the outcomes of events with 90% accuracy. Mm-hmm. And you'd say, oh, well, that's amazing. What are your methods? And they said, we sacrifice a child to an owl god. You know, I think a lot of people would be like, well, geez, I mean, that's terrible. Your methods are deplorable. But, you know, what's your line on the Steelers game?
Right.
I mean, if you're oriented towards self-protection, the problem is that I think they're dealing it with it more on like a practical surface level kind of thing. And they're not really digging into the depth of the psychology, right? The cosmos of the psychology that is going on for both men and women in those situations. And because it's more slanted towards men, the whole women do this kind of thing. I mean, this is like the whole pickup artistry thing too, right, is really not being very generous as far as like a lot of the psychology that's going on and a lot of the needs that are trying to get met in those situations. So yeah, they're good at making predictions. Like, yeah, they're good at explaining things and saying like, this happened because of this, and they might be right. But it's something that, you know, if I was a young man, I would just want to approach cautiously for that reason, for what it's kind of neglecting.
Well, yes, and I hear what you're saying. That whole sort of realm, I think, has made some strides, Brett, maybe since you kind of dipped out of there. There's some guys like Rollo Tomasi, who's been around in that for a long time, who kind of dig into the literature and take some cues from evolutionary psychology. And I think that they are quietly doing some pretty good sociology there nowadays.
Yeah. And it's like Peterson is dabbling in this as well in his work, which is one of the reasons why he drew so much ire, I'm sure.
Right.
One of the reasons.
That's exactly right. And you're right. It is male centric. It comes out of that sort of male, that men's rights movement. Nobody's stopping ladies from doing that sort of thing either and coming up with their own pills. But that's where this thing started to be, this whole, you know, colored pill code system started to be used to denote people's mindsets about certain social and political movements. And
can we just, like, if anybody doesn't know who Scott is, like, that's not the office of, like, some pickup artistry website that he's running. Scott, you know, lives in Oklahoma. He has two teenage daughters. You've been married, what, 25 years?
Yeah.
Yep. So you've been dating you were dating her since, like, your mid-teens before that? Yeah. Okay.
We've been doing this a long time, me and Charity. You know, got a 16-year-old and 18-year-old daughter. And I love all of them more than I love myself. And a whole lot of that stuff sure seems to be true, man. as I've observed these young women and even the wife. But this show is not supposed to be about that.
No, but it's part of, like, it's part of the path to understanding the pills, I think. So,
yeah.
It's all right.
And so outside of the sort of pickup artist realm and the, you know, Rollo and whatever, there was a whole men's rights movement who were very, very concerned about, really concerned about marriage. And you'll see this whole MGTOW, MGTOW, these men going their own way. People, some of them are on 4chan. Reddit used to be just shot through with them. In my opinion, have given up on life. but they talk about divorce rape, right? They're very wide-eyed about the modern male-female dynamic. You know, depending on who you read and who you believe, divorces are initiated anywhere from 69 to 90% by women. You know, outcomes in divorce courts can be very difficult and challenging for men. Men often get what they call zeroed out.
Yeah.
You know, from divorces. And it's not just about pickup and trying to get laid on Friday night. That whole red pill community is also like, you know, if you're going to get married, you need to know what you're getting into.
So a question.
Really what it looks like. That whole movement wasn't just about their groins.
Exactly. So a question that just to advocate for people who are listening skeptically or angrily to what we're saying right now, does this community expand to, like, I think you're saying, yes, it does. And I might just not have seen, I've heard a lot of this, like, filtered through the most simple forms, or I knew where this movement was when I started looking at it, maybe in like 2017. I hope they're putting a lot of attention to the larger cultural forces that are contributing to this. And, like, the example that I've given is, you know, before we go to public school, we're a little boat. And then we go to public school for 15,000 hours, and that gives us a sail, but no sailor. So it's like, all right, there's your sail, go out into the water, and it just blows you wherever the culture takes you, basically. Sure. So is this accurate descriptions of the way men and women behave in the culture largely unconsciously? I would say yes. Yeah. Because that's how they behave politically. That's how they behave in various aspects, you know, economically, socially, familially, all of these things. Philosophically, it's like, where did the wind blow them when they didn't have the critical thinker and, you know, the introspective presence to, you know, not want to be a part of that breeze or not want to be taken by it. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying, yeah, I hope that that's incorporated and you seem to say yes.
Well, it is. And just like any other movement, there's a whole, you know, look at the Free State movement. You know, it's just like that. There's a bunch of boneheaded guys who either cower in fear and are afraid of women for fear that they might lose half of their 401k and are hateful about it, to guys who are just trying to increase their success at the karaoke bar, to, you know, these more sort of rational sociology types that are kind of sitting in the middle, observing things and disenchanted with, frankly, you know, sociology departments and universities and the output from those that seems to be patently not true. Yeah. So, I mean, there's everybody in there, I would say. So whatever, you know, whatever you think about it, no matter how mad you get about it or whatever, it would be, I think it could be a good exercise for someone who's just encountering this stuff to maybe go get one of the Rollo Tomasi books and read it and try not to get mad and then say, you know, where's he lying? And if I think he's lying or wrong about something, why do I think that's true? And then you'll find that you carry some axiom in your mind that makes you disregard what he said. And then you need to really look at that axiom, and you may continue to hold on to it and then dissent with Rollo, or he may have you reconsider it, but it's worth doing. I think past the men's rights stuff and then the pickup stuff, and people, they don't really call it pickup anymore. It's game. I don't know. Not like I'm in this stuff. I've been paired off since like the first Bush, but game beyond that, it started to move into politics. And, you know, Aristotle tells us in book one of his Politics that, you know, the basic unit of a political organization is the male-female couple. I don't think it's a coincidence that political attitudes are also characterized by color-coded pills now, because I think that male-female dynamic and the different interests that men and women have influences the politics now more than ever. So we end up with, you know, monochromatic pills in politics mostly, right? You've got a white pill and a black pill and maybe a clear one if you're Curtis Yarvin and wrong as hell. But those are what they are. The white pill person is probably the normal person who at the airport watches whatever news television is on TV in the waiting area outside of gate 26A and takes it all at 100% face value.
Why is this not blue? Michael Malice talks about a white pill that is like, yes, we acknowledge what the black and the clear talk about, but there is hope. I thought there was hope in the black pill. So why are you calling that the white pill, though?
Well, okay, here's why I say it. I think those people are hopeful. I think that they go cast their votes in hope that they are a part of a mechanism that iterates politics towards a greater good. I think that they think writing letters to the editor does some good. They feel like they have political agency in the traditional ways that we were told we had political agency in.
Yeah, let me add this, because I disagree. I think that those people are the most objectively hopeless people that they are.
Oh, I agree. I
basically think that in a last-ditch effort to save their sanity, they're live-action role-playing some efficacy inside the system.
I think we're both right. You know, they're like live-action role-playing. I'm a good citizen. I wear my sticker that says I voted. They've never thought about it. And if they ever did think about it, they would go take a cyanide pill, maybe, you know? They can't not play out the scripts that we were told are effective political scripts.
Right.
And so in that way, I think they are LARPing. They don't know it. They didn't choose it. It's
sure.
Just LARP. So here's some more fortune. They're an NPC, right? They're a non-player character. They're not bringing anything original or new to the game. They're playing out scripts. And, you know, that's most people. And frankly, it might be a good way to go.
I don't know. For a lot of people right now, it seems utterly torturous, right? I've been pretty unplugged from social media and news for 3 weeks, you know, and this is just fabulous. I don't know how long it's safe to do this for, as I've commented elsewhere. Like, I'd like to know when the shit is about to hit the fan, but I have a pretty good sense. And
when is it? Tell me what time.
I have a pretty good sense that it's coming. Right. So I'm not going to be, you know, I mean, I've been preparing for it for a year. So I think there's physical preparation, but there's also emotional preparation. And I've done a lot of that work over the past. I wasn't ready in March for that. Right. But, you know, I've had a year to kind of acclimate to this impending situation, this trouble that is brewing.
I think that we need to talk about the black pill people here in a moment. But I think the white pill people actually have something in common with them.
OK,
it's all cope. Right.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, I think.
It's all cope, and that's okay. Nothing wrong with that. I think, you know, you got to get through the day. You know, we're here to live, not to work politics all the time.
But why is that? Wait, all right, so let's stop there then.
Yeah.
Why is cope okay? If cope is living, coping, I think, in the way that we've laid out so far, entirely requires living unconsciously. It's entirely avoidant from what I can see, unless you see something that I don't see.
Well, I think that some of it's avoidant and for sure, but you know, I'm trying to cope.
Yeah.
You know, we all undertake some sort of strategy to, you know, to minimize the noise coming at us and to be able to focus on the things that are most important to us. The white pill people and the black pill people are, I think, are both trying to stay sane. And one of them maybe realizes in a more wide-eyed way that, that most political action doesn't work because the system doesn't work as we were led to believe in the beginning. So they don't participate in that political action in the same way. That's the black pill people. That's me. The white people, just white pill people, just don't have that realization. They have a more rosy outlook that they think the system works, and that it's going to be okay. And they choose to believe that amidst all sorts of evidence that things don't seem to be politically healthy. Is it a conscious choice, or they're like, la 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 la, I'm not gonna pay attention to the fact that, you know, enormous civil unrest, no one on either side trusts the election process, et cetera. Right. You know, are they, la, 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 I don't know. Sometimes I wish I was that way.
Yeah, which I mean.
I voted sticker and felt good, you know.
I don't know. I see those people, like what I was saying before, like just looking at, I was talking about my social media near blackout, like I still go on there to post, but not scrolling through the newsfeed and not seeing a lot of like the left-leaning people that I either know from like college or no, they're not left-leaning. Let's not, that's a phrase that means nothing, is entirely inaccurate. People who identify as Democrats or liberals or progressives, the people that I'm connected to on Facebook, and I think it's, I've, you know, in this dark way, enjoyed being connected to them because it's almost a kind of theater to watch the things they think and post. But man, I mean, they just seem like the last 4 years have been torture. And then, you know, I talk to my father pretty regularly, full speed, Tucker Carlson, you know, that's what informs his worldview. He's just outraged, you know, he just feels this total outrage about everything that's happening right now, as if the movements and machinations of these, sources of power are something new. Like this is the first time in history that, you know, these kinds of designs have ever been discussed or implemented. It's the story of the 19th century, the 20th century, the 20th. This is not like, so for these people who have done that avoidant approach by trying to put everything in nice and neat buckets, I'm on the right, I'm on the left. And you see this, it's like people will play out these arguments like NPCs, like the scripts that they're given, right or left. Like, here's how this argument has been designed, pre-designed for us to have. So let's have it now in this, you know, semi-public forum that, where nothing gets solved. But if, let's just say, to the question of, is this the way to be? If the election somehow gets flipped to Trump, I mean, you are going to see nurses and school teachers throwing bricks through windows. Because they've been primed for it. You know, am I being a little hyperbolic? Sure.
No, I don't think you are. I don't fucking care. There's your black pill. I don't fucking care. Pick up your brick, Mrs. Jenkins, ninth grade English teacher. Throw your brick. Do your worst. Let's figure this out.
Let's see
where it's going, as opposed to me going down there and pushing that button and yanking that thing. And then, you know, voting for the degenerate, disgusting mayor in small town politics in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who does nothing he said he's going to do. He's politically identical to every other person that ran for mayor in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I'm supposed to vote for this asswipe and then be happy or feel responsible for his behavior because I cast a vote for him. I'm sick of it. You know, this is the black pill, people.
All right. Here's the thing. You're a man of influence.
Ugh. Gross.
I didn't say the word. I didn't say the word you don't like.
Yeah,
you have a large platform podcast. You've had a couple,
right?
Like lots of people know who you are. Do you not feel some obligation to comment on these things in a way that is constructive? Because I certainly, this is why I wanted to get into this black pill discussion with these friends of mine. Because I'm talking about like, if this happens, all of these people are going to do this. And then it is kind of like, well, wait a minute. Why do I actually care?
Yeah,
why do I actually care what they think or what they do? Should I not? Am I, like, from the platform that I have, doing my own kind of LARPing where I'm supposed to, like, responsibly assess and predict what's going to happen when it's totally out of my sphere of control? I feel like trying to be a voice of reason and a voice of kindness is a strong suit of mine. That's kind of like what I built my platform around. It's not an obligation, but I think there's an expectation that I'll do it. And I don't think you're in like a totally different situation.
Oh, so nobody tunes in to me to be a voice of kindness or reason, Brad. Come on.
A voice of reason, maybe not kindness, but reason.
Well, see, as part of, so what's the black pill? Let's hit that real quick and then we'll come back to what you're talking about. So the black pill is the black pilled people in terms of politics are disenfranchised or disenchanted with American political process. They understand that it, or they believe, whether they're right or wrong, that that large scale politics works in a much different way than we were told. They do not believe that they have efficacy in politics in those traditional ways: voting, letters to the editor, writing your senator, all that kind of stuff. They just don't buy that anymore. They also typically, you know, this isn't a monolith. Nobody even really agrees on what the definitions are, but they also typically believe that they've lost, that they have to find a way to live with the situation and do what they can.
So they were what libertarians were injecting into the political conversation all the times that Ron Paul wasn't around.
Right? I think that libertarians are white pill as hell, useful idiots, continue to try to use a non-libertarian political system to bring about their ends, when there is no way in that deterministic system that a libertarian political end can be achieved.
Well, that's capital L libertarians.
Fine.
All right. You don't make a distinction. If not, why not?
I don't. Why? If you are a classical liberal or a big L libertarian, which I assume you mean somebody who's a member of the Libertarian Party.
The people who are trying to make the tent so big that basically anybody can fit under it and then try to twist the party into what they want it to be, which we've seen over the last 5 years.
First of all, I am a fallen libertarian. So I have a great deal of sympathy and understanding for those people and love for them. But they basically don't understand game theory, and they do not understand how to use political power to bring about a political end. Their philosophy is frankly, to not use political power. So they are hamstrung from the very beginning. They are not willing to use the levers of power to bring about a libertarian or classical liberal end. And even if they were to fall ass backwards into that and obtain it, they don't know how to use political power, which is state force, to ensure that they maintain that.
Okay, so there's lots of shades in that, though, right? You're using one word to describe a philosophy, but then, yeah, like I don't like pragmatism as a philosophy, but I was a part of this New Hampshire scene where some people were just total leave me aloneers, agorists, like, you know, people who've just gone completely off the map, completely off the grid. Then you had like the civil disobedience crowd. You had the entrepreneurship crowd that was like, all right, we're realistic enough that we want to protect businesses and our families. We hold these values, but we're going to play along. We're not going to be put in a cage, right? So, and I think
any of those camps,
yeah,
actually seize political power.
Okay, so that brings us to the last group. The political group, right? The people who went to, and these were the people who generated a lot of conflict. So we had Concord, the state capital, Keene, the civil disobedience, you know the scene there, Free Talk Live and, you know, filling parking meters and filming yourself, dealing with cops. The Seacoast was more of the family, entrepreneur, unschooling, like a lot of my people, the people in my audience are there. But Concord was the political. So there was always this conflict, especially between civil disobedience, like the purity of that, even though it produced nothing and actually wound up alienating something that could have caught on in the live free or die state from basically everybody because of the approach that they took. And they only cared about quantity, not quality of participants. So they wound up attracting a lot of like unimpressive people. But the project in Congress, so I have a friend who was anarchist AF, and he basically is in a leadership position in the Republican Party in the New Hampshire State House. Mm-hmm. And this is a difficult thing because we are surrounded in New Hampshire. Vermont, which is not like a total progressive state, it's kind of a weird mix of like rural culture and progressive politics to the west. Massachusetts, which is basically China to the south. And okay. Maine, that is more progressive than Vermont politically, but also has some of that rural culture stuff mixed into it as well. But all of those, and then there's Canada above us, right? So we're surrounded. But, and then, you know, Connecticut, New York, those places aren't that far either. So if like there is a balkanization of the United States, that doesn't look good for New Hampshire.
Right.
Right. That's the culture, the political culture of New Hampshire is probably not going to survive a balkanization, unfortunately. So the awareness was, in kind of a Game of Thrones way, which I know you're kind of unfamiliar with that, but in the show, there's a wall, right? And people got to watch the wall because what's trying to get to the other side of the wall is, you know, worse than having to watch the wall, right? So it's kind of like that trade-off. It's there are people who have migrated from Massachusetts and other places to New Hampshire because they see it as a small enough state where there could be a very easy political takeover. And this is a thing I've been hearing about my conservative father talk about since I was 10. Right, is that all these Massachusetts people are coming up here to flee their bad tax situation, and they move here and they raise the taxes. You're going to have that in Oklahoma. They've got a major problem with that right now in Texas. They've got a major problem with that right now in Arizona because of the exodus from California. So New Hampshire was one of the first places that really dealt with that because Massachusetts was so close and it was so easy to flee. And those people who want to harness the political machinery of New Hampshire, they go to work every day and they love it when people like us don't show up. So if somebody said, well, I have a principled opposition to participating in the political process, these people would be like, you know what? I support you endlessly. I support you endlessly in your opposition of not coming to the state house and not looking at the law that's being passed. So I think there's many shades of people who would still identify and who would still like want to move the libertarian conversation and values forward, but they are in touch with, you know, the game theory aspects of the political system in this country.
Perhaps. So you've got your undercover incognito mosquito friend who's an anarchist working for the Republican Party. But I think I'm so black-pilled that I think that our political process is a deterministic system, that there's only about one outcome you can get out of it, regardless of the inputs.
It's not even about getting an outcome, because the outcome is we stop this thing from happening.
Right.
Right. All you can do, and that's why I use the Game of Thrones wall metaphor, because all you can do is hold the wall. Right. All you can do is hold the wall. And this is like super not black pilled and overly optimistic. Well, people build solutions in education or in economics or in business that present better alternatives than what the state offers. But that project has obviously been slow compared to the steady march of left wing politics in New Hampshire. Right.
Right.
But that would be the most optimistic assessment of that, is hold the wall while people can build opportunities that show another way of doing things.
Right. Which brings us to Yarvin's clear pill, where Yarvin says, take the clear pill. Maybe your team lost the presidential election. Take the clear pill, hunker down, wait 4 to 8 years, and then spring back into political action at that point. And 8 years is a long, long time. We can have all kinds of Aristotelian revolution happen in 4 to 8 years. And I don't think that's an option. You know, Yarvin's clear pill, and maybe I have a simple, my understanding of it, maybe it's too simple. Maybe I'm making too much of a shorthand of it right now. But essentially, it's a white pill in that he thinks that normal political action will work. But he's saying, well, when your people aren't in power, sit back, drink your tea, mind your own business, try to be sane, and try to find a way to exist within that system. And then when the opportunity, you know, when the opportunity presents itself again in the future, spring back into action.
Yeah. Okay. So I've heard him use the example of like expatting to another country a couple of times, where it's like, what's your buy-in going to be to the system? Not very high, but does that mean you're going to like speed and break the law? No, you're going to fit in. You're going to go along to get along. With a low level of investment in the, you know, the political structure, the political future. Well, you probably have some. I mean, if you've expatting to a place, you probably have some investment in the political future of a place.
Right.
But you might not be heavily involved. And from everything that I gathered about this clear pill idea, if there was a call to action, it was something like detaching yourself from a desire to change the world is exactly what is needed large scale to change the world.
Yeah. And I think that he may be right about that in some ways, because, you know, like I've already said, I think that the system, whatever that is, I'm making scare quotes. Why am I the only person with a camera on today? Is everybody nude? Does everybody live in a dump?
My lighting's probably not very good.
Oh, my gosh. I've already said that I think that the system is deterministic and has like one outcome that can come out of that thing. And so in one respect, him saying that stepping out, you know, finding a way to you know, exist and, you know, abide by the speed limit, not go to jail or whatever in your example, Brett. And then, you know, and then kind of working outside of it is probably the only way it can be fixed. I listened to the show you had with the cousins about the black pill, and And I agreed with them a lot. I think that political praxis for regular people has nothing to do with voting, aldermen, House of Representatives, the Supreme Court, or really anything else. It's about creating culture, probably at the household level. And for the Greeks, politics is about the polis, the city. You know, how do you live? How do you live with the other people in your polis? And that's how political practice for normal people has to be. I don't see any other way around it. Even if, like, let's say that our regular political environment was healthier. Let's just say, for example, this is probably not true at all, but let's say during the Eisenhower administration, it was healthy. It's probably not true at all, but let's just say that it was. I don't, for the purpose of discussion, I still think that basic culture creation at the individual praxis level is still the most important, this important way to take action politically and to bring about some sort of a change.
So this is what we talked about the last time you were in one of these meetings: work ways, food ways, and folk ways.
Yeah, and spiritual ways. Yeah.
And spiritual ways. Yeah. Are how a culture gets built.
I think so.
Yeah. And you can really see, like, the political identities of states break down if the states are large enough and you just drive far away enough from, you know, the political centers of those places. So I spent a lot of time in the last week in New York. Mm-hmm. I was on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Holy shit. The way that place looks and feels right now, and the way it always, like, looked and felt, but it is, it was frightening, right? Mm-hmm. I complimented a man walking down the street without a mask on for, "It's nice to see another smiling face," while we were sitting there loading a moving truck. Right. And he made some like conversation. It was very nice and, like, very unexpected from all of the other, like, rushed, head down, mask on kind of behavior that you see. And I get it. It's probably a law. I mean, you probably have to have a mask on to walk around outside there. But you get in your car, you drive an hour north, and there are towns having Trump parades, literal Trump parades. There are, you can go down a street an hour north of the New York metro area, and there are, like, homemade Trump billboards. Not that this is an answer, right? But it's absolutely the opposite of what people picture the political culture of New York being. And this is true in every state. You know, it's true. Like, I remember when I was out in Oregon and I was talking to farmers, and they're like, "Yeah, this entire state's run by two cities. And yeah, everybody else here is just a leave me alone owner."
Yeah, the political divides here are basically rural and urban, and I could talk about that for 15 hours. But I went on a road trip with my dad the other day, about 4 hours in the truck with dad to go pick up some stuff. And the quote, as near as I can remember, is, "I don't give a fuck as long as they leave me alone." I think that was as close as I could get to him talking about the political situation. Mm-hmm. And that's just not an urban sentiment.
Right.
You know, if you live in a super high density area, you know, leaving people alone and being left alone just isn't a possibility. You know, there's just the teeming masses. You just can't take that attitude, because everybody's in the polis is too dense. You know, that everybody's interests are too entwined. Everyone's far too specialized. There's not enough self-sufficiency in there for someone to be left alone.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the changes in the regulations for your green grocer means that you can't get kale or what. I mean, it's just, everything's just too entwined and everything seems to be of your direct interest.
That was one of my contemplations when we were there. This was Tuesday. We were down there and just, like, thinking about, like, driving a truck through the city and just observing, like, all of the things that are happening that nobody's even aware of, but with this sort of timing, mm-hmm, and how the chain reaction of one thing going wrong, how many people could possibly be affected?
Yeah.
You know, like somebody triple parking on a side street, or there's lots of examples came to mind, and there were lots of things, yeah, that I had to kind of consider when we were down there, just how one person's actions or mistakes or unconsciousness could screw up for how many people in that place. So yeah, you do have to have much more of a hive mentality in that place. It's easy to talk about in terms of, like, defects of city people.
It's an eventuality. You can't avoid it. Like, if you, yeah, live in the city, that has to be the attitude you take. You know, there's a reason why they will cane you for spitting gum on the sidewalk in Singapore. Because less, if 0.1% of the people in that city did it, you would be ankle deep in gum all the time. Like,
right.
The consequences of allowing people to spit gum on the sidewalk in a city like that are actually enormous. So the response to it has to be proportionally enormous. Whereas I've got live on 30 acres, and if I spit gum on it, no one cares. And I don't even care because I'll never step in it because it's 30 acres. But my dad, dear old dad, I love, he's also sort of white-pilled. Like he said, oh gosh.
Dads are.
Well, I'm a dad.
You know what I mean by that.
Yeah, boomer dads. He's like, oh boy, you know, if Biden and Harris get elected, oh my, you know, whatever. And I was like, Dad, nothing's going to happen. They're the status quo. Like nothing's going to happen. Like Biden's been in there for 47 years. She's been there for decades. She's just a San Francisco political machine output. You know, nothing's going to happen. They're the status quo. It's the same, same.
See, I totally disagree. And you're talking like a man who's never seen the film Weekend at Bernie's Part 2.
I have
not. All of this is laid out where all the bad guys say, you know what? We can use this corpse.
Right.
If we go to the Caribbean and we get this woman who knows voodoo, we can animate this corpse and we can use it to get all kinds of stuff done.
So she's part Jamaican.
If anybody is thinking that this is status quo, I mean, I would say go get yourself a VHS copy of Weekend at Bernie's Part 2, where the whole plan here is laid out. But if you also think about, yeah, I mean, these people operated in this system where obviously they were just driven by what their self-interest was the entire time. And a lot of things throughout, you know, Joe Biden's political career that were not possible are now possible now, as far as like exercise of power. In the year 2020, we've watched, and this is one of the reasons why I was hopeful about some kind of outreach and wake up and raised consciousness, or at the very least raised curiosity that might lead somewhere. In 2020, we watched the government's, yeah, everybody has watched the government walk up to their front door, walk up to their front door in a way that they have never done before. And now I think that this political left, it's like, we're the people of science and we're the people of responsibility. They have been empowered to respond. Yarvin talks about this as well, right? Like the polarization and the dark versus the light, the good versus of evil. Now it is time for an overzealous, over response to what the unenlightenment that this country, the anti-science, mm-hmm. the anti-civility that this country has endured for the last 5 years. A savior is coming. And yeah, these people are gross. And yeah, these people are useless. And yeah, they've only acted in their own self-interest and furtherance of their own political careers. And yeah, they're, you know, neoliberals and corporatists and all that. But they are entering power, if they do, at a time where they are certainly emboldened. And obviously, you know, they're, I mean, as far as like the non-government organizations that really have the power to shape the world, these people will bend over for them in a second. You know, whether we're talking about the WHO or the World Economic Forum.
Or Twitter or Facebook.
Like there's a kind of nexus of, you know, all of these bad actors that are going to feel emboldened by this change of power. And that power is going to feel emboldened by all of their corporate and media and globalist allies as well. So I hope you're right.
I think we're both right.
Only one of us has seen Weekend at Bernie's Part 2, though.
Well, that's true. No, I think we're both right. I think the establishment and the system has a deterministic outcome, which is what you're saying. I don't think it matters who's the president. We're headed there. Like if the Supreme Court hears this Texas v. PA thing and rules in favor of Texas, overturns this so-called election, and then Trump gets put in office, the thing burns. If the other people get put in office, the thing burns. It is established. So mote it be. I think you're right, but I don't think it matters who gets elected. I don't think it matters. It's all the same game. Doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
How about that? It's the black pill, man. It doesn't matter. Let that teacher pick that brick up. Throw it, honey.
I don't know. I liked the renewed empowerment idea that Cousin Nick brought to that conversation about, you know, kind of saying something that I've said on this show from the beginning, like operate in your sphere of control, right? Yeah. Reassess what your sphere of control actually is. Now, when I first said that on the podcast in 2010, ironically, I was also a Stefan Molyneux protege who was telling people that what we're doing is saving the world. Mm-hmm. We are the heroes that will save the world. And I went, that sounds great. That's I think a lot of political people are kind of stuck in that kind of thinking or that kind of like storytelling today.
I think it might be true though.
But well,
saving the world doesn't look like the Independence Day movie.
Right.
It means keeping the light on. So after the vandals come and the smoke clears and Rome's in rubble, somebody still has the books. Somebody still has the ideas. We can still do math. We still have some intact families. We still have some consciousness of what correct political practice is and can rebuild the thing. Like reform is not possible. You know, Aristotle talks about this, and I think it's book 6 of The Politics, where he says there's a life cycle between these 5 regimes and there's nothing you can do about it. You know, you start with an aristocracy, which is basically what we had at the time of the Constitution, where you had these gentlemen scholars running designing the system and running it. You had a very, very small voting franchise. It had to be landed white men. Good, bad, or indifferent, that's what it was. It was the aristocracy of that time that then devolves into a democracy, then an oligarchy, then a democracy, and then you end up with tyranny. It's a cycle. You know, Aristotle pointed it out 2,400 years ago or something like that. It's played out again and again and again. Stupid France seems to get into a loop where they go democracy, tyranny, democracy, tyranny, democracy, tyranny. They're on the fifth estate at this point or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what happens. So we're somewhere in a oligo-democracy right now, and we're going to tip over into tyranny. And there's nothing any of us can do about it except what we can, which is very community-based, very familial, and about self-reliance, in my opinion. You know, I'm working hard to get to the point where I don't have to buy any food. And it's not a prepper thing. Like, I think the whole thing's so broken that the food is affecting us.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I hope at some point to have roughly 1,100 grandchildren, and I hope that we can grow enough food that none of them have to eat any modern food. So my political praxis is much different. You know, I don't read the paper. I read a few blogs. The other day, wife and I got up before daylight, and I got down in a ditch trying to get ahead of the rain and put 400 yards of a water line in so I could have water for some animals down below a hill, and worked all day in a muddy ditch and got out, and we're going to have good potable water there from my well. And during that time, I had no idea that Texas had filed a Supreme Court case. And it was absolute delight.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with smaller scale projects. You know, I'm not digging wells, but I'm looking seriously at the future at what I do. And I know how much bandwidth I have. Maybe there's ways that I can work on expanding it mentally in the future, but that can't be anywhere near the top of my priorities right now. What's happening in the news. I'm powerless against it. I know what I have power over and who I have power over. One person. And that's where my focus needs to be. And the way that that feels, and not you know, accepting this false idea of an obligation to comment on the things that are happening in the world as they happen. I see people who do that, and I applaud them for their diligence and, you know, somebody like Tim Pool. But I have no idea, just from my perspective as a human walking this earth, I have no idea how he does that.
No.
And I don't know if he's younger, or if his brain just works in a completely different way. But I see somebody do that, and I say that definitely has a finite life. That's not a long-term project. And I also accuse every other media creator of being on Adderall, too. Because I was like, there's no way a person could naturally be that way. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Because I have friends who certainly have a lot more space for that kind of stuff than I do. But I don't have it, and I feel like I'm better for it. And I think that, like, just back to the Stefan Molyneux thing, maybe Steph was right. And maybe he just made it sound more grandiose than he was, because, you know, I looked at having doing something, you know, back 10 years ago when I was young and naive, and the world seemed like a place where you could take action and make a difference. We were sort of in the height of the Ron Paul, or we were between two Ron Paul ages at that time. So there was a lot of optimism for libertarian ideas and, you know, the ability to pull people out of the education system. I feel a renewed possibility of that right now. But over time, it was kind of like, maybe my project is to help, you know, hopefully a growing number of a few thousand people strengthen and preserve their sanity and feel like they have some community and feel like they have some support and feel like they have a place to get some ideas. And maybe Steph saw it as a similar kind of thing. And that was, if enough people did that, and there are a lot of people doing that, that that would be a kind of solution.
Yeah, I think that Steph's peaceful parenting approach and all
sure,
that
yeah.
2008 to 14 Steph stuff is probably right. But understanding the scope and scale of that and how long it takes is very, very important. But, you know, how is he going to tell an audience, hey, listen, this is going to take about, I don't know, 400 years, okay?
Yeah.
It's hard to galvanize the masses.
But it's also exactly what people want to hear, right? Because there was just as far as like maybe creating this kind of illusion of self-efficacy, mm-hmm. to not have to be able to quantify your progress if you're only going to live for 70 or 80 years, and you're told this is multi-century,
yep.
dozens of generations, even you're like, oh well, I kick the can down the road out of my sight. You know, but I don't need a feedback loop. I don't need a feedback loop. I just have to keep doing these things that make me feel good, which is what I think is actually a pretty, what you called white pilled or what I would call blue pilled political attitude of uninformed hopefulness about what we, and that was a huge part of the libertarian project. Like I'm sorry, but a lot of the things that Ron Paul was saying were wonderful, but practically inserted into this world and all of the machinery of this world, both state governments, national governments, international governments, it would have been absolutely catastrophic if he took office in 2009 and implemented any of those ideas. The world would have responded with something far worse than the problem he was trying to solve. And that enters us into, you know, plenty of opportunity for conspiratorial explorations about some of the problems that Trump has encountered during his presidency when, you know, he was trying to do a far more modest version of like a Ron Paul makeover of the political system in the United States. But we don't have to get into that.
Yeah, and you can't even do a makeover. So you audit the Fed, then what happens?
Nothing. Exactly. Right. Nothing.
If you're interested in some of these things that I'm talking about, as far as, you know, what does action look like that is outside of this normal political arena, you know, Carl and I have read on and discussed on the Online Great Books podcast, Miller's book, A Canticle for Leibowitz, a little science fiction book where he talks about, you know, how some people try to keep the lights of civilization on after a nuclear war. And then also Alistair McIntyre's book, After Virtue, where he talks about development of a community leads to a teleology of man. In other words, he says that man figures out what his purpose is from his community. And then once you know what that purpose is, you know what the virtue of a person is supposed to be. You have to know the purpose to know what a virtue is. The example my partner Carl always gives of virtue in this classical sense is you have a piece of steel, and if it's going to be a knife, it needs to be sharp and good at cutting. And if it's going to be a hammer, it needs to be heavy on one end and good at driving nails. It's all steel, but you know, knowing what its purpose is and its fitness for that purpose tells you what the virtue is. So I think that we have to develop virtues in this community. When I say develop virtues, I don't mean in the William Bennett Book of Virtues sense. That has been a perversion. We have to actually understand our role in the community, understand what is needed of us, and then craft ourselves to meet those roles and those needs. And then once we do that, we'll know what a virtue is. And once we know what a virtue is, we can determine what justice is in that context. McIntyre in that book says that this book was written in 83, I think, says that we don't have any political future because different political factions have an incommensurable view of what justice would be. We sure see that now. You know, a social justice warrior is yelling about social justice. You ask them what justice is, they really can't tell you.
It's retribution. They can tell you. They can't tell you with the word, but they can tell you with their action and their orientation. It's retribution.
It's retribution. And the libertarian thinks that justice is really a license. They want to be able to do whatever they want to do. And those two, everybody has an incommensurable view of justice. And so there's no way that we can legislate, that we can govern, that we can even be neighbors with these incommensurable views of justice. So we have to resurrect role in community. We have to determine our purpose, teleology from that role. And then the ideas of virtue and therefore justice will follow from that. And it's been destroyed, mostly been destroyed in the West, and we're going to have to recover it. And it's going to take a long time. You can't just sit down in a think tank and determine what justice is. You can't do that. It's normative in some ways. It's not relativistic. It is objective, but it is determined by roles in the community and the needs of the community. Figuring those kinds of things out is going to take like real life work in the dirt with people.
Yeah. It's kind of, if I could just add this, I was talking, a friend of mine just moved to Austin, Texas, and I was helping him.
Damn it. Texas is full. Oklahoma's full.
Well, you know, he's a young guy, single. He's done a lot of work on himself, and he's looking to maybe like meet some women. And I said, well, in Austin, Texas, you're going to encounter a certain type of woman who has values different than yours. And I think you should go have those experiences. And I think you should practice. And I think we kind of role played some pattern interruptions that he could do in that process, like when they start just talking about Bernie or how excited they are for Joe Biden or whatever. And I think one of the things we came up with was maybe try to say, I think if people are talking about political solutions to problems, everything that was actually important about the creation or the expansion of that problem, they missed. So it relates to what you're saying as far as like the cultural, the logical, the philosophical, the psychological. By the time you've got a political problem on your hands, everything that contributed to its cause, it's already too late. So related to this black pill thing that we're talking about, I was happy to have a conversation, and the clear pill as well. I was happy to have a conversation with people who did not feel like it was synonymous with hopelessness or despair, because I don't think it is.
No, I don't think I'm pessimistic. I think I'm realistic, and I think there is hope in certain arenas, and none of them have anything to do with Washington, D.C. that I'm aware of. I think that's good.
Yeah.
Let's talk about partition.
Partition?
Yeah, or secession, or...
How long can you stick around?
All day. It's raining. No, I was going to work outside today. I'm not interested. It's like 31 degrees and raining.
31 degrees in Oklahoma. Wow.
Listen, Oklahoma, we never really have to worry about the Californian exodus here because the weather is so fucking horrible here. Like, you can't hardly keep concrete on the ground for roads because it'll get below zero and it'll get to be like 114. The temperature extremes here are just brutal.
That sounds like a moon.
Yes, that's
something
good.
Without an atmosphere.
Keeps the riffraff out.
Yeah. Before we go any further, all of this pill talk that we've done, does anybody have any questions or comments or need for clarification? And this very well could wind up being a podcast, so I'll just throw that out before people go on mic. But if anybody has anything they want to add or ask, this would be a good time.
What?
I know. I know there's people who want to, too. I don't know if they can right now.
Somebody's mad as hell right now.
Yeah. They might have already left.
Right.
Yeah, I think the people who are mad already left.
Yeah. Okay.
Good. Pick up the brick. I don't care. That's more of my... Okay, this is something I want to talk about, Brett.
Sure.
So, you and I are somewhat in public, and we use our names.
This was a mistake that I made. Yeah.
Yeah, and so the 4chaners, the frogs... They call that face f***ing.
F-A-G-G-I-N-G?
That's right.
Okay.
Your face f***ing. And because they understand, and I really bristle at, not the name. I don't care about names. I don't. You can call me anything. Like, my old lady loves me. My kids are good. You can call me anything. I don't care. But the Chans and the Frog Twitter really are hard on people that aren't Anons. And the reason for that is they know that if you use your name in today's political environment, you cannot say the things that are necessary to be said. Now, you said Tim Pool a while ago. Tim Pool isn't particularly edgy, but he does political commentary. And there is a whole arena of speech and idea that he cannot touch for fear, frankly, for his life or his property or his credit card processing or use of PayPal or Patreon or whatever, right? And this is kind of a part of the black pill community. Like there's a part of that community that's like, oh, you have to be an Anon because that's the only way that you can make the kind of political speech that's necessary to bring about any sort of change. I get in trouble for saying lots of things, and I don't say nearly all the things that I need to say. But I'm not in a position to do that.
because political power lies, most of it actually lies outside of government at this point.
Absolutely, yeah.
There is a legion of people out there policing behavior, like literally on the street in some places. We are in a corporatocracy where the HR department, if you have a job, or Twitter, Patreon, whatever, Chase Bank, WePay, Stripe, whoever, makes it difficult for you to make a living if you speak outside of the norms and so on. So a lot of the more, well, like Curtis Yarvin, who we're talking about in the Clear Appeal, he was a Mencius mold bug for years and years and years. And it was an anon until he got doxxed and kind of doxxed himself and kind of shook that off. And by the way, his views have kind of moderated since then. And he's much less interesting than he was when he was mold bug. I would not enjoy, and me enjoying what I do is important. I'm not a martyr. This is not a holy crusade for me. So I need to enjoy it. It needs to be fun. And for me to be in an on and maintain that would be very stressful. I wouldn't enjoy that whatsoever.
I think you lose a lot of authenticity too. And we see this problem. Like I have this, I know who the guy is, but there was this guy, he was like a college professor. This was like over 5 years ago and he wanted to be on the show. He said we were all wrong about the Trivium. Well, not all wrong, but he said you guys are making some mistakes about the way you're presenting this. Of course we were.
Okay, fine.
Of course, like you go to press and you make mistakes and over time, kind of like this is some kind of a cult that misleads people. And I just said, you're not a constructive part of this community. You're not likable. You're very abstruse. No one even understands what you're talking about. So like, it's time for you to go. And you started creating like all of these anonymous identities to continue to comment on the website. And they just got shittier and shittier and shittier. But then you go on YouTube and that's what everybody is doing. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of it on Twitter as well. You know, like we have a Facebook group. I don't admit anybody who looks like they're trying to achieve anonymity in any way. Mm-hmm. I want to see your kids, you know?
Yeah. Is that a threat?
No, I know. I want it. Like, this is me. I'm putting myself out there.
Right.
You know, those are the kind of people because that brings authenticity. And when that was lost from the web and, you know, anonymity took over in the way people interact in a lot of these places, it's that the results haven't been good. It's the difference between, you know, honking at somebody in your car and bumping carts with somebody in the supermarket, as I've always said.
Yeah, I think it's yes and. I think you're right. Yes, the anonymity allows people to be their worst selves. But it also, you know, the Federalist Papers, Publius, it also allows people to speak freely when free speech is hard to come by. So it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah,
I moderate the things that I want to say because my name is Scott Hamburg and everybody knows what it is.
Right.
I absolutely do not get to say the things I want to say because of my identities out there.
Right. The most thought that I put into it is maybe around like 2011. I said, yeah, I should have used a pseudonym in case I ever need to go back to work doing what I did before this. I don't even know if that's impossible. You know, at this point, like I think I could find, like I've made enough connections that if I wanted to go back to like doing some kind of academic support, I don't think I ever do. But I could now find people who were like on board enough with the message of the show that I could do that. But I didn't know that when I started this. I just said, yep, this is my name. This is what I've done. Eventually I said, this is where I used to work. Mm-hmm. Once those people went to jail. when was the first time that you became concerned about having your identity out there for the reasons that we're concerned about that today?
Second grade. I'm not kidding you. I remember being aware that the teacher was wrong about certain things in matters of fact, not matters of opinion, when I was in around the second grade. I would speak up from time to time, and it didn't go well. You know, the teachers would go to the teacher lounge. Teacher's lounge, they used to smoke in there in those days. And they said, that Hamburg kid. And so Miss Strauss told Miss Dobbs, and in the third grade, that bitch was ready for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm serious.
Nope, I had the same problem. My conservative dad was chairman of the school board. So right. I'm wondering if like public school was otherwise for most people a positive experience if your dad wasn't conservative and the chairman of the school board. But, I remember hearing teachers saying, you know, that's so-and-so Vanat's kid.
Right, right.
I won't dox my dad. No wonder he's such a shit, or no wonder he's so obnoxious, or something like. I overheard teachers like saying something like that.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and my mom tried to be an activist within that system and go to the school board meetings and all that stuff. Well, you know, we were only going to be in that. My sister and I, we were only going to be in that school. I was going to be in there 12, and she was 4 years behind me. We were only going to be there for 16 total years. It takes longer than that to do anything in one of those places. And so my mom was in there kicking that hornet's nest, and we were over there getting our asses kicked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my sister eventually bailed out of there. I went to another school, and I think she had a better go of it once she moved out. I was too game for the battle, I guess, to leave, or maybe it didn't even occur to me to leave. But no, I was aware of it right then. And I'm serious about that. I've known that my whole life. I didn't really start doing these podcasts and stuff until I sold my business in 2018. I had done a strength podcast, Barbell Logic, but we were talking about strength. You know, I didn't talk about ideas. I didn't talk about my opinions, really. You could, you know, my character would come through, but I didn't really talk about that stuff at all until I sold that large, small business in 2018 and stopped having corporate clients. Yeah, I've been aware of it my whole life. It is worse and worse and worse. I had a Barbell Logic podcast listener that hated my guts, and I had reason to believe that I needed to view him as dangerous. And he hated me for my political views. At one point, I was in Portland, Oregon, and he lived fairly close to there. And I was at a weightlifting meet, strength lifting nationals in Portland. And he and I was on the podcast and a known strength coach. And I knew that guy knew I was going to be there. And I thought, I may have to kill this fucking guy.
Yeah.
He didn't show up, but it was a real life. It was a real concern that the guy would have showed up. I've had other people who are anons come at me. I've got a blog at scotthambrick.com. I've had some people come at me on there, and they're just bold as hell, you know, when they're anonymous, and I'm not. And I dox them.
Yeah.
Oh, you doxed me. Hey, I don't fucking care. It doesn't matter. There are no ethics here, you know. There are no objective ethics online. There's just not in terms of that. Like, if you know who I am and you're going to snipe at me and I know who you are, and then I'm supposed to just like tie one arm behind my back and not let any of my followers know who you are, or not hip anybody to the fact that you hate my guts and where you might be in case something bad happens to me. That's ridiculous. I dox them.
Yeah. There's no objective ethics online. It's a shame that it's pulled so much of the entire consciousness of the world into it.
Right.
Where there is no objective ethics, but yeah.
It's disgusting. Political praxis. You know, so you're right. Like the way online works has influenced the way people behave offline as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a social divide among people who work in that informational world and the people that work in the world of the concrete. Right. You know, in the 70s and 80s, or maybe even today, they would talk about blue collar, white collar. Well, now that divide is even wider than it used to be. And the white collar people, this is really interesting. The white collar people think that they are superior to the people who are blue collar, mostly. These are all these things we talk about are generalizations, but you can't talk about hardly anything at all without generalizing. And I hang around with a lot of blue collar people, and they know otherwise. And they also know that it doesn't matter what happens in the accounting department, or what happens on a spreadsheet, or what happens with SAP, the SAP suite that operates in somebody's enterprise. If the blue collar people don't do what they're supposed to do, blue collar people in a lot of ways are more polite because they understand that there are physical consequences in the world. You know, if you do something wrong, your fingers get mashed. If you make the wrong guy mad, he might break your teeth off.
Yeah.
They tend to have some boundaries that I'm finding that the people that live in the internet and the information world don't necessarily have because they're uncoupled from that.
Right.
And I am looking forward to the day when the blue collar people realize that they actually have all of the political power in the country, every bit of it, and exercise it by not fixing the toilet, by not delivering the food, by not trucking the goods. You know, Stripe isn't going to process your credit cards because you said something that wasn't cool.
Yeah.
What about if you can't get a single person in the pipe fitters union to fix your building, or the plumbers union to fix your toilet, because you're a dick?
No, I mean, you could destroy New York City in 5 days.
And they need to go ahead and do that. As soon as they think it's time, they need to just go ahead and do that. Because that's the safest way forward. That's the safest way forward. The fewest people will die that way.
Why? I'm skeptical.
It's better than shooting.
It's better than shooting.
It could bring people back to understand how precarious things are, to understand where the real balance of power is, to understand that they are operating on the, frankly, at the courtesy of those that have the real power.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe it could be more explicit and they could say, hey, everybody, 4-day shutdown on everything we do, just so you see who really has the power. And we'll see how you like it. And then maybe after that, we can talk about how we can balance things a little bit better.
Yeah.
But
the comments here, Pamela says, proud blue collar at Small Business Heritage. And then Sydney says, I tensed up at the mere mention of that. But that's the truth. If some dude, if a bunch of guys at the co-op in Iowa are like, we're going to sit on this corn for 18 months and we're not going to plant it next year.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's better than a shooting war.
No, I agree. I honestly don't even think that that's really, aside from like some tiny pockets where things temporarily get out of hand. It's a problem. Like we talked about in that Black Pill show, written housing, right? Mm-hmm. If people want to do the written house approach, they're just contributing to the problem while they think they're doing this great individual act of sacrifice. I mean, I don't know what Rittenhouse thought. Maybe he was just kind of put into a panic situation and, you know, he had the tools to defend himself. So he did.
Rittenhouse is probably white pill. He thought he was doing the right thing in the context that he's from.
Yeah.
And he goes in there and it blew up on him, I think. But he's a kid.
Right. Not anymore.
Crap. Right.
Unfortunately.
The Iowa corn example I give is going to be pretty tough. Like if people get hungry enough, they'll take that corn, but they can't make you fix their septic tank. My brother-in-law, who I love very much, he works at the power plant and keeps the gas turbine spinning so that your lights come on, and the ventilator works at the hospital. Those guys are geniuses and they understand the world in a much deeper way than anybody who works in the informational world or for a tech company could possibly understand. If those guys get fed up, it's the political winds will change instantly. Instantly. And it'll only take about 5 to 10% of them to do it. You know, my brother-in-law, not going to dox him either.
Yeah.
He's brilliant. He's a gas turbine mechanic and makes electricity for this part of Oklahoma, essentially. There are probably 3 guys in the state that can do what he does. There are probably 600 in the country. I don't know, 1,000 in the country that can do what he does. He's in his 40s. It's taken him since he was probably 17 or 18 years old to attain the knowledge and the skills to be where he is and do the things he does and manage the things that he manages. You can't make guys like that instantly.
Mm-hmm.
If they decide that they're not going to participate because you haven't respected their needs and wants and wishes and marginalized them and taken advantage of them, then your refrigerator is not going to run. They are going to win. That's what real life political praxis looks like. It's not voting for some asswipe for alderman or whatever. Stupid.
No, that's just a way of like you doing nothing, having no power and feeling like it's also your fault that you didn't get what you wanted.
Yeah. One of the things that Thaddeus Russell said on your show one time, he talked about how democracy is so oppressive.
Yeah.
Because of the requirement on everyone to know about everything. Mm-hmm. And I feel that. Like, if you're going to be a responsible citizen, you need to understand the sewer system when you go vote on the bond election for the sewer system improvements. You've got to understand foreign policy. You know, you need to feel like you're a Kissinger so you can vote for the right person, but so that they, promote the right Secretary of State. You know, you've just got to know too much if you're going to try to be responsible with it. And I feel really oppressed by that. So I welcome our contractor overlords. That's what I'm saying.
So you do like the Yarvin approach of this like authoritarian path to a freer society?
That's the only way you can do it. You can't just say, guys, please make it freer.
No, I mean,
point guns at people. I'm sorry. All political power is in fact power. And once you obtain it, you might choose to use it benevolently or not at all. But you can't get it by just begging for there to be less. It's ridiculous. And I don't even think this is an opinion of mine. Like you just go read history, go read Herodotus, go read Thucydides, go read Livy, go read Gibbon. It's just what happens.
Well, everything that we were promoting in the libertarian conversation 10 years ago required a mass public awakening. It's kind of like any sort of I don't want to say purely utopian, but like if something is completely ideologically driven and completely disregards a pragmatic approach, right? It requires, you know, it's like, I forget who I was talking to. I feel like it was you or Carl. No, it was Kevin Cole. It was my friend Kevin Cole. We were doing our In Pursuit of Utopia show. And he says, everything is a Fabian strategy. He's like, people are, you know, super critical of Fabian socialists, and there's room for criticism there for sure. But anybody who's trying to get ideological adoption from a large group of people in order to bring about change has to use the Fabian strategy, mm-hmm. right? There has to be a gradualist approach. So like, yeah, we don't like the politics of these people who employed the Fabian strategy, but whatever you're trying to do, if you're like an ANCAP or a libertarian, you're going to have to use it too. Right. And you're going to have to you're going to have to set aside Stefan Molyneux's 500 years for that. Right. So, yeah, I mean, it actually, and to think about that, think about how much passion I still have for those ideas and how much I like to contemplate the possibility of a world like that. But all with, you know, full awareness of all the things that are not in place for that world to come to be. Yeah. I mean, that's a long project. And I'm trying to circle back to the point that I was trying to make about that, but that mass awakening, we have watched the possibility of that disappear. If it ever existed, and I'm not sure that it did.
Never existed.
But it has become, you know, in clear relief in the last 5 years that that was not possible. Yeah. People could not do it. I remember like 10 years ago on our show, we were just like, you know, there's all these fallacies that people keep using. And if we showed people what they were, then they wouldn't work anymore. People don't give a fuck about that.
No,
they just don't. And, you know, yeah. I'm glad that I found a group of people who do
sure.
and who are defending themselves and maybe trying to do outreach with the people that they care about. But yeah, I mean, this is about strengthening self and preserving sanity. And, you know, I don't have much hope. And I've been saying that a lot this year, but I don't have much hope for the rest of the world.
Yeah. No, yeah, you shouldn't.
No, I know. It's sad.
Most it's people sad. Just believe what they're told and do what they're told to do. You know, the mask thing, I think, is evidence of that. People are told that they work and that they should wear them, and they just do. And then the incidence of the disease just keeps on coming on, and, you know, and they just keep doing it, and they yell at you if you don't wear one. You know, they just... But the conservatives and the people of the right have been loath to tell people what to believe and tell them what to do. Just really interesting to me. Mm-hmm. The left never stops doing that. By the way, everybody's going to end up with COVID.
Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. Yeah.
Virtually everybody. It's like chicken pox. When I was a kid, you know, everybody got chicken pox. It killed some people, which is not good. But everybody got it. And then when you were around six, you know, you'd bring it home from first grade and your little sister would get it. Yeah, it's everybody's going to get it. Everybody's going to get it. But yeah,
I mean, my brother has it. His whole family has it. Right
yeah,
now.
I got it. It's horrible flu-like symptoms. Wife got it. Kids got it. They didn't really even get sick. They had a little scratchy throat and felt poorly for a little bit. Onward and upward, you know. I don't. But people tend to, most people just tend to believe what they tend to believe what most people are telling them. Right. So if most of the media is saying X, they just tend to believe it. And then there you go.
Yeah.
You're not going to have an awakening.
You're not going to have an awakening.
That's another thing about my version of Black Pill, which is, and I've talked about this on my, I got another little weird podcast I'll do when I feel like it. I call it Scott Stream.
Yeah.
When I'm really mad or irritated about something, I just can't not talk about it. I'll just talk into my iPhone microphone and then just put it out on there. I think a lot of us are fellow travelers. And by the way, I think, Brett, that our fellow travelers aren't necessarily right or left, right? They're just Black Pill. I think a lot of our fellow travelers need to be Black Pilled to the point that they start trying to figure out how they make a living when everyone gets canceled.
Yeah.
You know, where's your income going to come from? What's your banking going to look like? I have a friend. It's a female friend, that it's female is important, who is a university professor in California. She thinks she's conservative, as only a conservative in California could think.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm from Oklahoma, and I know the difference, and she don't.
California has as many words for liberal, has like as much understanding for liberals as like Eskimos do for snowflakes. You know, they've got like a million words for snow and they've got a million words for these different liberals. And so she's not cleanly one of those. So she thinks she's conservative. And she worries about her university job. And I haven't talked to her in a while about this, but I told her, yeah, you ought to be.
Yeah.
Like you're really safe politically in my view, but they're going to get everybody. So you need to be worried about it. You need to find a way. And then you can be free. Right? She has very moderate views and is chilled to the point she doesn't think she can say hardly any of it. Like even in her own home, I think. She needs to find a way to diversify her income sources, her banking, and everything to the point that she can say her very moderate stuff. And, and I think we all need to do that. And you need to do that, Brett. And I need to do that. And not for political reasons, but just so we can sleep at night. Can you imagine hand-wringing because you were afraid that somebody's going to like scour your Twitter feed and then call HR and now you got out of work and the baby needs diapers? Like, it's terrible.
When I started to see the possibility of these things coming, I became much more of a minimalist. Mm-hmm. We could do a whole conversation about this sometimes, but for a variety of like personal, economic, and political reasons, I've always been apprehensive about having children.
I really, really need you to get your genome out into the universe.
I know, but
what can we do to get you into a gal today? not a car, but a woman.
That'll be a future conversation. Let's maybe seriously think about doing that show in a couple of months. But anyway, yeah. So, I mean, I live pretty light. I'm pretty mobile. You know, if I had to, I could go somewhere completely different. And, you know, most of my best connections are with people online. You know, in New Hampshire, I have roots here. It was one of the reasons why I wanted to come back.
Yeah.
But like I have family here. But in this current situation, you know, I was talking to my mom last night. I was like, I'd love to come see you, but I was just in a red zone in an apartment building. And, you know, let's hold off on that. So my life is set up to be adaptable, which is good. And, you know, I have money to live on. If I suddenly get to platform from everything, I do production work for other people who will probably be lower on the list of deplatforming than I am. So, you know, I feel okay. I feel pretty secure. I have the things I need if shit suddenly gets much, much worse. And I really feel for people who don't, or right, for people who don't have the kind of flexibility that I do. But I had a lot less of it at the beginning of this year. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in a city,
right?
Standing out on my porch, counting with my finger, house by house, all my neighbors that I didn't know.
Yep.
You know,
this whole urban like rural divide thing is so interesting. Like I'm a barely reformed Oklahoma redneck. Barely. You scratch the veneer and there's just redneck under there. Mm-hmm. And I lived in Tulsa. People that haven't been to Tulsa, it's almost a million people in the Tulsa metro area. It's a real city. It's, I don't know, it's like the 48th media market in the country. It's not tiny. It's a big city. It's not Houston, it's not LA, it's not New York, but it's a big city. And as a result, it has a city ethic about it. And over a year ago, I bought a big plot of land out in Rogers County, Oklahoma, where I'm from, and wanted to get the hell out of there. And in July, I sold my large, fairly expensive Tulsa home. We would tell our friends from time to time, we put the house up for sale. Oh, really? Well, why did you do that? I said, well, we bought 30 acres out and, you know, we're going to build a little house on there and go live out there. Now, I bought this house that we sold in July thinking I was going to live there forever. It had all the hallways were wide. There were no thresholds in the house. Like, it's wheelchair accessible. It's like 3 miles from the level 4 trauma center. Like, I was going to live there until they threw dirt on me. No kidding. Mm-hmm. That was our intention. My wife and I bought it. That's why we bought it. Well, we changed our minds. Over and over and over again, we would tell these people. They'd say, oh, you put your house up for sale. What for? Well, we're going to move out here to this 30 acres we bought. It's rural property.
over and over again, they'd say, well, that's what you've always wanted to do. I was different. They could tell. Mm-hmm. I didn't know I wanted to do that. Maybe they either knew something about me that I didn't know, or they knew I didn't fit in. And when I told them I was moving out there, then they got it.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, yeah. So, yeah, why don't you get your redneck ass out of here? Mm-hmm. But you know, I didn't know hardly any of my neighbors. We lived in a upscale kind of country club. Well, it's across the street from Southern Hills Country Club that hosts the PGA tournament from time to time. Neighborhood. We lived in that neighborhood for 6 years. And I knew one of our neighbors.
Yeah, I hate that. It's kind of actually one of the frustrating things about the experience in New Hampshire is like your neighbors don't care about you. And that really, like in Pittsburgh, I could have if I wanted to.
I didn't care about them either. Like,
I get that. And I'm not losing a lot of sleep. Like, are they okay? How are they doing? Like, I don't give a shit about that either because like my world is so, like a lot of us today, I mean, my world is very large, right? Like I have people all over the world that I can talk to, and it kind of has changed or maybe affected, and maybe not in the most thoroughly thought out way, my need for roots and connection that are physical and bound to a place where I kind of, you know, where I feel like I come from. But in Pittsburgh, you know, Pittsburgh is a very like multicultural in a way that works kind of city. And I could have gone out and I could, you know, before all this shit happened, I could have knocked on doors and I could have said, hey, I'm Brett. I just moved into 3349, you know, that house down the road there. And there were block parties and yeah. Everybody waved and it was a super friendly place, but it was just a little too, and the population density wasn't even that bad. The city's like 1600 people per square mile, which is not terrible. And I lived on the outskirts of the city near a park, near escape routes. It wasn't the worst situation, but I didn't know how bad it was going to get. And I left. I probably left too soon too. That was another thing that I realized. I probably could
have stuck it out there. You didn't know that though.
Yeah, I didn't know that. So anyway, I think we're going to wrap up for today. If nobody has any questions or comments, I have something else I have to get onto at 11:30. But Scott, this was awesome. And I appreciate you taking all this time to chat with us. We should do this more often. And this forum is always open to you, of course.
Well, yeah. Say when, give me a little heads up. And especially if it's 31 degrees and raining, I'm in.
Absolutely. So with the 9 minutes that I can devote to this before I have a heart out, does anybody have anything they want to add as a comment or a question?
Come at me, bro. What?
I see. Here's the thing. Like, there's lots of people on this call who are very talkative, and I love that. But I think this had a little bit of a different feel today. Like they were watching a live podcast, and now maybe right. It's a little trickier to chime in. So I get it if nobody's up to it, or if you feel like we covered everything. Like, geez, these guys settled it all. So,
I'd kind of like to talk at some point, Brett, about, you know, what that sort of small scale political action might look like, and maybe for this forum and not wider, not because I am faith, and not wider distribution. Talk a little bit about what we're doing, and not that it's the right thing, but it is something it's what we're doing, mm-hmm. and actually have that be a conversation among everybody. You know, what are these people doing? What are they thinking about doing? What are they considering doing in terms of, you know, shoring up their business prospects, their finances, their food sources,
yeah,
all of that stuff. And I have been working on that stuff very hard. And I want to say again, I said it earlier and I'll say it again, I'm not a prepper. I think that the food, the community, the finance, I think all that stuff is political, and have been working on that. Because I want to isolate myself from the wider politic and build something that hopefully attracts other people and lets us build a community. And from that, the telos will follow. From that, the virtue follows. And from that, the notions of justice can follow.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would love to have a strategic conversation about that at some point and get input from people in this group. So this is people who, you know, attended the university, and it's also people from Richard Grove's Autonomy Group, which is a very cool community. And, you know, Rich teaches this course that has obviously like self-sufficiency, like surviving and thriving in these times built into it at several parts. So if we could get a really good turnout from both of our groups one day, I think that we could have a really great conversation in here. So
I have a contingent at Online Great Books who is hardcore, like making their own tools.
Yeah.
Building home foundries, permaculturists, home educators, like just self-sufficiency people. They would be doing it no matter what. Again, there might be a little bit of a prepper aspect for some of these people, but most of them are about complete self-sufficiency.
Yeah.
And you really can't be libertarian unless you're self-sufficient. You can't do it.
It's no.
Unless you're self-sufficient.
It's the safest and most sustainable act of rebellion I think you can do. And I've tried to expand it into as many areas of my life as possible. There's still a lot of work to do, but I'm always inspired by, you know, hearing the story, like what you're doing out there in Oklahoma is just awesome. So
if you wanted to do that, I know that a lot of these folks here are, I think they're probably subscription members of like Richard's community and yours, but if you want to put together a quorum, there's a handpicked group of people I could probably get from OGP that would come who are doing some wacky stuff that is and are brilliant. They're really interesting folks. So we could bring them. And I know I could bring five.
Yeah, absolutely.
I could bring a whole lot more if we wanted to, but there's five really good ones that are, got some interesting stuff to say. So yeah, that'd be fun. I'd be interested. I want to learn about that. I want to learn from those folks.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm all for it. Let's do it. Well, we'll talk. I'm sure we're going to talk before Christmas anyway. I don't know what I'm going to do with this. I don't know if this is going to be a podcast. I'll listen back to it and decide, but it will definitely get posted where people can hear it. And thanks for everybody who came and listened today. And of course, Scott, you put your website up.
Yeah. OnlineGreatBooks.com or ScottHambrick.com. If it's all right with you, Brett, I'll probably put this on that Scott Stream podcast feed.
Oh, please do. Yeah, absolutely. I'll edit it and send it to you, though, beforehand, if you can wait a few days. If people are interested, Online Great Books has open enrollment right now. And this is not for people who are listening. This is only for people who are here live.
Because
the enrollment's going to close Sunday the 13th. So if you just go to schoolsucksproject.com and go to any podcast page, just click on the Black Pill Show, you'll see that there's a link in the sidebar there. There's a section that says self-educate, and there's a link to university, and there's a link to Online Great Books. So you just click that link and enroll or get on the waiting list if you're interested.
Yeah, The Great Books and the Black Pill. That would be another good show.
All right, everybody. I'm going to go eat and get on to the next thing. But thanks again, Scott. And we'll talk soon.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Have a good day.
All right. Bye, everyone. Must be getting early. Clocks are running late. Paid by number, morning sky. Seems so funny. The dawn is breaking everywhere. Yeah, let a candle across the glare. Draw the curtains, I don't care, 'cause it's alright. I see you got your list out. Say your piece and get out. Guess I get the gist of it.